From the cowardice that dares not face new truth. From the laziness that is content with half-truth. From the arrogance that thinks it knows all truth. Good Lord, deliver us. Amen. One night in my first semester away at college, I got back to the dorm room kind of late. And when I got back there, I saw on my answering machine a blinking light. Now, those of you who are young might not know what an answering machine is, but it's kind of a square type device, and people would call, and if they missed you, they leave a message on it. And when I came in, I hit that play button and heard the sound of my father's voice saying, "Laura, this is your father. Give me a call back. If you get in before midnight, call me. If you get in after midnight," long pause, "well, you shouldn't be getting in after midnight." Click. That was it. At that moment, my father was leaning into the age-old adage, "Nothing good happens after midnight." Our behaviors in the darkness tend not to be the best. In fact, this is statistically proven to be the case. Theft and criminal behavior, addictions and abuse, all of this is shown to happen more in the nighttime hours than it happens during the day. And a friend who worked once as the intake coordinator at the UNC ER, and she worked the night shift. And she would tell harrowing stories of what came through those doors, haunting, disturbing stories. And she claimed they happened more on her shift, the night shift, than those who worked during the day. Paul, in the passage here today, speaks of what he calls deeds of darkness. And he talks directly to the church faithful, and he encourages them and asks them to, quote, behave decently. And he talks about this image and says that they are, quote, supposed to put on the armor of light. He talks about the necessity of watching our behaviors, in fact, throughout this whole pericope, which uses a number of themes and images. It talks about love and law and sleepfulness and being prepared and darkness and light, but all of it kind of comes down to this same fundamental point. Behavior matters. What you do matters. How you act matters. What you say matters. How you carry about your life matters. Now, all this practical stuff might get you to think that Paul is not interested in the big picture. But those of you who have studied the epistles, particularly studied Romans in particular, know this is not the case. Paul is huge about the big picture. Paul talks very little about the life and teaching of Jesus. Paul is hyper concerned that you get the big narrative, that Jesus died on a cross, that Jesus saves our sin, that Jesus is a Jesus who calls us to acts of faith and glory and goodness and hope. Paul is super into theology. In fact, Romans is probably the most steeped in theological work that Paul writes. And yet, while Paul is all enthused all the time about the big ideas and this big God and God's big salvific act, Paul chooses to end his epistle to the Romans with these chapters that are very practical, that bring it down to earth and say, we believe this and it means this. It looks like this. It acts like this. Now, I have to say, as a member of the clergy, as somebody who's out among the church, one of the things you'll often hear me talk about is that we are the space that talks about the whys. We are the sanctuary, the classroom, the youth group. We are the activities where we challenge and grapple and work with the whys of life. Why does this happen? Why is this so hard? Why did this unfairness occur? Why did they get hurt? Why, God, why? All of that is fair game in church life, and we are to be the first ones who grapple with those questions, who ask the big questions. Yet at some point, the whys have to turn into the so whats. Why we do all this is so what? It matters. So what are we going to do about it? So what are we going to say is different about our lives because we know that God is a part of them? That we know that God is a salvific God who is working about redeeming our lives and our world. So what does that mean for us and our place? I love the fact that this epistle to the Romans that is lofty and theological was written while Paul was going and trying to get money from the people to help to address the famine that was going on in Jerusalem at the time. It was a fundraising effort. So here Paul is fundraising, working, talking to the people, trying to help an immediate need, and yet he's also writing this epistle to the Romans. Paul would be the first one to say, you got to think here, but you got to do here. You got to love here. You got to pray here. You got to know what is going on in people's lives. Just this week, I was talking to one of our staff members about how I love the announcement time in the worship service. Now, I have to say, this makes me a bit of an oddball preacher. Most pastors do not like the announcement time. They try to put the announcements at the very beginning or the very end, or say, read your bulletin, and don't include it in the worship, because they feel, and I understand, that the announcements can be disruptive to the flow of worship or distracting to the theme for that day. But I'm the one who feels that the announcements are where the rubber hits the road, where it gets interesting, where we talk in worship, we praise in worship, we read scripture in worship, we proclaim in worship and do all these big, good, glorious things. It is the announcements where we find out what the church is actually doing about it, what they're talking about, what they're studying. It is the announcements we find, hey, we're going to have a small Bible study. It is in the announcements we find out we're going to have this Habitat group. It is announcements we're going to have this fellowship group. It's in the announcements today that we're going to have Kona Ice for our children and youth. I don't know exactly how that connects to the Bible, but I'm sure it does. Because you're going to want to be here, and there's going to be joy and abundance and ice, and it's all good. And that's where the two connect. And at the end of the day, if our beliefs are lofty and our beliefs just stay somewhere floating up in the academy and they don't get lived out in the church and in our lives, they're meaningless. That's what everybody's looking for us to see happen, that those two connect. So when Paul talks about these concepts of love and law and living in the light, they are not meant to be high in the sky theories. They are meant to be lived out realities. So let's unpack that just a bit. What does that look like when you take these big, big concepts and you put them in real earthly language? Well, for one, he's really direct. He says love means love your neighbor as yourself. If it's something that I want, if it's something that would make my life more purposeful, more meaningful, more hopeful, more good, more positive, more godly, my neighbor wants that too. So how am I going about making that possible for my neighbor, knowing the neighbor is doing the same for me? What would our communities and our society look like if we were truly bound together by that kind of powerful love that is fundamentally directed outward towards our neighbor? Likewise, the challenge Paul throws in there is that this kind of love, this kind of outward love, means that we love our neighbor and that we do not harm our neighbor. We do not go about and practice ways that are disempowering, that are hurtful, that tear at the fabric of our society, that disabuse or hurt another. We don't do those behaviors. And we have to be self-critical enough to be able to think, what are our behaviors doing? Are they building up our neighbor, or are they hurting them? John Wesley, the founder of Methodism, claims three simple rules, not just for his own life, but for all of us with this label of Methodist upon us. The rules are do good, do no harm, and the more modern translation of this is stay in love with God. Do good. Do no harm, stay in love with God. stay in love with God. And you might say, oh, it's so difficult, it's so challenging, love is complicated. Yes, it is, but it's not that challenging. It's not that complicated. At the end of the day, we need to start somewhere, and but what better way to start with do good, do no harm, stay in love with God. Love, this big concept, is as practical and as close to us as the person sitting beside you right now. That is the neighbor you are called to love in this moment. When you leave this place, you will see many, many more calling your name. We got love. We got law. Now, law, you think love is challenging? Law takes it to a whole new level. We get so mired in the law, so confused by the red tape. We have so many layers upon bureaucrats. We have so many boxes to check. We have so many times where we blame things or lack of activity or confusion upon the system, which has gotten so big and so calloused and so harmful. I recently read a book called A Man Called Ove. It's a great book if you get an opportunity to read it. But one of the side points that stood out to me is that it was written by a Swedish author. And in it, the character he describes is a character who's constantly running into the bureaucrats, people he calls the white shirts. And every time he tries to do something good or redeeming or helpful for his community, these white shirts come in and they shut it down. But what struck me is that it's a Swedish author in a Swedish place. And I thought like the Swedes were uber loving. You know, I mean, if anybody was going to love their neighbors, they're the ones who park their kids in strollers outside the grocery store and leave them out there while they go shopping. These people are the ones who should get it, right? And yet the book has, even these people have white-shirted bureaucrats who are unable to get past the law in order to see the love. And yet this is what Jesus is calling us to do. Paul says that Jesus wants us to get past all the red tape. He wants us to cut through it all, and he wants us to put the law of love first and foremost, to be able to see that law and practice that law and claim it as the law to end all laws. So we have this love that we've got to own and make real. We have this law that we have to make real, and that it becomes so much part of our lives that we don't even think about it. And then we have this whole part about living in the light, the behaviors of living in the light, the activities and the actions and the conversations. And Paul goes on to describe it as living in the light in such a way that it's clothed around you, that you are just covered in Jesus Christ, that when people see you and interact with you, they think there is something different about that person. It is all around, that light-filled, loving living. The Lutheran pastor Nadia Boltzweber calls this kind of living in the light life a life that is consistently offering casseroles from God. Now, I love this image. I know she's Lutheran, but we can share the Lutheran and Methodist love for casseroles, because we certainly, as Methodists, understand casseroles. They are the quintessential offering of comfort and love, and they're also in convenient, freezable 9x11 form. I mean, they are simply amazing. And Boltzweber reminds us that we are called as a people to be in the practice, both metaphorically and literally, of constantly offering casseroles from God. Being the people who are practicing those acts of kindness and encouragement and hope, who are rolling up our sleeves and saying, how can we help? It might not be glamorous or grand, but it is glorious in the way that it brings about healing when you hand over a prayer shawl, when you put together a flood bucket, when you hold someone's hand and help them up. I think this is important and good news for any day, but I think it's especially important and good news for us today. Because the questions and issues of the world, the climate literally that we're in right now, is so awful. There are storms upon us. We are hurting and scared. And you know what? There will be a time and the place to kind of grapple with and ask those whys and work on them. But I don't really think that time is now. We're living in that part of Romans that says we've got to get real, folks. We've got to get busy, folks. We've got to get working, folks, because God is depending on us. The world is crazy. And people are looking to us because we chose not to sleep in this morning. Our cars are not home this morning. They're thinking, where are they? And when they come home, what are they going to do that's different? How are they going to profess a kind of love that I'm thinking, man, I want a part of that. Where is our rubber going to hit the road that makes it matter? A friend of mine just mentioned to me that she feels that she is simply on information overload right now. She can't stand another headline, another political debate, another conflict or world issue, another natural disaster. She can't bear to see it. She's moved from the point of emotional fatigue to near numbness to it all. And in that kind of collective climate, we don't have time to talk about the whys, because the world is looking for the so whats. The world is looking to us to be the people of God that make a difference, that are a people doing practical theology, working where God calls us to work. I want to show a film at this moment. It's 3 minutes long. It's entitled Twice in 18 Months. It is a short film that's put out by the Louisiana Methodist Conference. And so I invite you to turn and to take a look.
Hi, my name is Roger Templeton. I'm the pastor of the Welsh Memorial United Methodist Church in Vinton, Louisiana. I have another little church in Sulphur called Maplewood Methodist Church. So Vinton is pretty much the last stop before going into Texas on I-10 in southwest Louisiana. So these homes were flooded during the Harvey storm itself, and some were flooded as a result of the Toledo Bend Dam reservoir that was released. Once Harvey passed through, she continued to dump rains north of Toledo Bend. All of that flowed into Toledo Bend, so they had to relieve that pressure on the dams. Just beyond the playgrounds, tree line, just beyond the playgrounds, is the actual Sabine River. So we're that close to where all of this water should be. All of these, even those that were looks like this might have been spared from this year's flood, but all of these our second year floods. You know, 18 months ago, these homes were flooded. We were rebuilding, got them back into their homes. Many of them didn't return, but those that did now are flooded out again 18 months later. That's the big challenge, pastoral care-wise, is caring for people who had some hope and some future back in their homes, and now we're told it's a 100-year flood, and now we're back at it again 18 months later. Just a lot of despondency last year, we kind of got the sense people were saying, yeah, we're going to rebuild, we're going to get back at it. And this year, you can just tell their countenance is just not as positive and hopeful. They're just feeling defeated. This is not something they train you for in seminary, I'm going to tell you.
My name is Mandy. Lord's taking good care of you.
Fortunately, though, there are people who've been through it, even pastors who've been through this, who times like this, it's amazing what our connection does, pulling people together, and I've never one time felt like I was alone in all of this. What I do know is that bad things happen like this, and we are faced with a choice. We can give up, we can throw our hands up in despondency, both in life and in our faith, or we can answer the call that's really always there, even when there's not a catastrophe, because bad things happen on a daily basis. We lose loved ones, marriages end, jobs fail, and that kind of thing. But Christ gives us the spirit to endure, to overcome, and to reach out in concern and love to our neighbors so that we do, in times like this, what we ought to be doing on a regular basis, every day, and that's being the hands and feet of Christ. Thank you.
am thankful for my colleague in the Louisiana Conference. I'm thankful for his work upon the people there. I see how he names the extent of the tragedy. He takes this opportunity to film it and to share it with others, but also how he names that this has occurred twice in 18 months, how this 100-year flood has, in fact, not taken 100 years to return, but merely 18 months, and the people are hurting because of it. He speaks some of the wise. He notes that there are problems in the world, and we question why God lets those happen. And yet, he then goes into the actions. I love the way that he calls out to the person in the house upon the shore. I love the way that he bends into the truck and prays with the man. I love the way that he says, without a doubt, he knows the Methodist connection is there for him. And that he knows that we are called to be the hands of feet, and that this is our enlisting day. This is our call too. Because our God is a God of action. Our God is a God of reality. Our God is a God that's greater than all these floods and turmoil. And our God is depending on us today to roll up our sleeves, to get in there, to love our neighbor, to share the light, and to preach his glory this day and forevermore. Amen.